Now, if you want to watch March Madness, there's no shortage of options. The old-fashioned way, of course, at home on your TV, or you can stream it on your computer at work. But as NPR's Sammy Yenigun reports, the hot ticket this year is streaming on your phone. There's an app for that.
First things first, for most fans, the best way to see a game is from the stands. That's a given. But if you're like Ryan Guthrie, an Indiana Hoosiers fan living in a city far from home, you've got to have a plan B.
I would always prefer to have a big screen, a big high-definition television screen, if I can. I mean, I guess I'm just old school.
For the past few years, Guthrie and his fellow IU fans have come to watch Indiana games at the Union Pub in Washington, D.C. They're draped in red, double-fisting chicken wings and beer. These guys are pumped that Indiana beat their rival Purdue in the last game of the regular season. And then there's Mike White from Madison, Wisconsin. He's new school. He's watching on his phone while waiting for the subway.
I knew I was going to be in D.C. with my family, so I said, well, I'll download the app so I can see the game while I'm out there, because I didn't expect there'd be any place that would have it.
White says he was at home watching the Badgers play on TV, and he saw a commercial telling him he could stream games on his mobile device. You know, there have been a lot of those lately.
Did you just check the game on your phone?
What? No.
Only AT&T's network lets your iPhone download three times faster.
And only on Verizon's 4G LTE network.
T-Mobile's super fast 4G smartphones bring the game right to you.
The push to watch games on your phones is coming from a few places. TV networks, cell phone service providers, and the NCAA are all highlighting the big dance on a small screen. Dawn Perry is a director of applications for T-Mobile. She says there are two reasons that mobile streaming is especially hot this year.
One, the smartphones that we have are getting larger screens, higher definition screens, so it's really fun now to watch on your phone. The second thing is the 4G network, and that means you get better picture quality, you get better sound quality if you're listening to it on the radio.
Streaming the game itself isn't the only way to enjoy sports on a phone. Twitter chit-chat around live sports grows louder by the second, and bracket apps abound in mobile app stores. This year, ESPN doesn't own the rights to mobile stream March Madness games, but through apps like Watch ESPN and ESPN Score Center, they're still trying to pull eyeballs towards phone screens.
They're often to us the very first screen many of us look at in the morning, before even turning on NPR, for instance, and often the last screen we check it at night, before perhaps even tucking in the loved ones.
That's ESPN General Manager of Mobile, Michael Bale. He says mobile's the fastest growing platform for ESPN, with over 20 million unique visitors monthly and counting. ESPN now calls mobile phones their first screen, which means that they design all of their coverage around how sports look on a phone.
And then we extract from those principles to include how we then program to both the PC, the television, and even the print experience.
This year, the Madness will tip off at 14 courts across the country and will be watched from more places than ever before. Sammy Yenigun, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
Now to the kind of technology that may be able to beat us at our own game, or in this case, a crossword puzzle. And here's your clue from New York Times crossword puzzle editor Will Schwartz.
The world's best crossword solving program.
The answer? Dr. Phil. That's F-I-L-L. Not to be confused with the talk show host of a similar name.
Let's do it. I want you to get excited about your life.
No, this Dr. Phil solves less complicated problems with solutions that just go down and across. It's a computer program, and it will be an unofficial competitor at the 35th Annual American Crossword Puzzle Tournament later this week.
Matt Ginsberg is CEO of OnTime Systems, a software company that specializes in optimization algorithms, and the creator of Dr. Phil. He also constructs crossword puzzles for the New York Times, though he admits...
I'm a terrible software.
solver, and I figured this would be a way for me to become a better solver sort of through a proxy.
The way Dr. Phil solves crossword puzzles isn't unlike the way its human counterparts do. It looks at all the clues, tries to understand them, and then fills in words, trying not to make mistakes.
But its understanding of the constraints that come from the crossing words is much stronger, and it's doing much more sophisticated numerical analyses.
Solving crosswords involves so much knowledge, so much stuff that's not in books, that's not in any database, that it is it's amazing to think that a computer could solve a crossword.
That, again, is Will Shortz, who directs the Crossword Puzzle Tournament. He's also NPR's Puzzle Master on Weekend Edition Sunday. Shortz says he looks forward to seeing Dr. Phil live up to its name, but the good doctor is not without its flaws. Again, here's Matt Ginsberg.
Somebody may have a puzzle that's about rabbits, and they'll have Bunny and Clyde, which they'll clue in some bizarre way. And Dr. Phil knows about Bonnie and Clyde, but it has no idea about Bunny and Clyde. That's not a phrase that's in any of its dictionaries. And somehow it has to realize, oh, Bonnie and Clyde is wrong, Bunny and Clyde is right.
Dr. Phil might bring to mind a certain computer system that bested two Jeopardy champs, Brad Rutter and Ken Jennings, last year, IBM's Watson.
Go again. Beatles people for 200. And anytime you feel the pain, hey, this guy, refrain. Don't carry the world upon your shoulders. Watson.
Who is Jude?
Yes.
Just before Ken Jennings lost to Watson, he joked that he, for one, welcomes what he called our new computer overlords. But fellow humans, take heart. There's always the off switch.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Carbonite, automatically backing up computer files for individuals and small businesses worldwide. Learn more at carbonite.com.
This is NPR News.
The Ford Motor Company has made money for 11 quarters in a row. It was the only one of the big three automakers to avoid a government bailout, even though a few years ago, even before the recession, it came close to failing. The new book, American Icon, details how Ford avoided that fate under the leadership of CEO Alan Mulally. Renee reached the author of that book, Detroit News reporter Bryce Howard at member station WDET in Detroit.
Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
You started reporting on Ford in 2005. What kind of story did you think you were going to be telling?
Ford was such an iconic company, and I knew that I was witnessing either the failure of an American icon or its resurrection, and either one was going to be an amazing story to tell.
And at that point, Bill Ford Jr., the great-grandson of Henry Ford, was the CEO. What was the breaking point that led him to give up that post?
Bill had been trying for a number of years to find someone to help him lead a turnaround of the automaker. He had reached out to some of the real rock stars of the auto industry, and they had all turned his request down. He really reached a breaking point in the summer of 2006, and Bill was convinced by the board to step aside and to make room for someone from outside the automobile industry. And the one thing they knew they wanted was someone who had experience turning around a major corporation and doing it successfully.
Well, they got that with Alan Mulally. He had turned around Boeing. Let's listen to Mulally in a story NPR aired in 2007. At this point, he's been on the job for just over half a year.
Everybody said Boeing couldn't compete, and the United States couldn't compete. We didn't have the work ethic, and we didn't have the commitment. And, well, Boeing's back as the number one airplane company in the world, and there's no reason that Ford and the United States can't compete.
And he sounds so calm, yet Ford was heading towards bankruptcy at that moment in time. And it reminds me of something you described throughout the book. Mulally always was the first one to get over bad news.
It really had a tremendous effect on morale at the company. I mean, Ford had been down for so long, people had forgotten which way was up. And Mulally came into this company with this incredible grin plastered across his face that never faded. And everyone kind of waited for this to kind of wear off. Everyone waited for him to realize just how serious the problems were and become dejected and fall into the morass that so many of his predecessors had when they recognized the scope and the magnitude of Ford's problems. Mulally never did that.
Well, the challenges, as you suggest, were great from the outside, but also the corporate culture at Ford you describe as noxious.
It was one of the most caustic corporate cultures ever seen anywhere in business. This was a company where people put the advancement of their own careers and the success of their own divisions ahead of the company's success, ahead of even the bottom line. You know, a car was designed in Europe, and it was designed in such a way that the car could not be sold in other regions. And as a result, America lost out on a really good product. So Mullally came in to a company that was really at war with itself.
So he was able to bring people together and get people at every level working together.
Yes, working together is kind of the name of his own personal philosophy. At the executive level, he tied executives' performance and therefore their bonuses to the success of the whole company rather than their own divisions. With the unions, he held a secret meeting with United Auto Workers President Ron Gettelfinger. He told Gettelfinger, if you work with me to come up with a contract that will allow me to make small cars profitably in the United States, I will take this key product, the Ford Focus, and I will build it in the United States instead of Mexico.
Okay, at this point, really, one wants to say, what's Alan Mullally's weakness?
The one area that I think that he has been tone deaf about is his own compensation. I mean, just last week, he received another stock award worth approximately $35 million. He took an extra $1 million bonus kind of infamously in early 2007, the same day that 10,000 white-collar workers found out they were losing their jobs. That's probably, you know, one of the things that he's had a blind spot about is his own compensation.
There is a lot of speculation about how long Mullally will stay at Ford. When might he leave? And what would that mean for the company?
Well, I think that's a very important question, Renee. I mean, the thing that he's waiting for is he still has one more part of his turnaround that he hasn't accomplished, that he wants to accomplish. It's very important to kind of put a flag at the end of this, and that is to restore Ford to investment grade. When Ford's credit rating is restored to investment grade, the company gets back all of the assets that it mortgaged back in December of 2006 in order to finance his turnaround plan. And that includes the Ford name, the Ford Blue Oval itself, which right now are still in hock. He wants to get that back to kind of put a period at the end of this.
Bryce Hoffman is author of the new book, American Icon, Alan Mullally and the Fight to Save Ford Motor Company. The book is out tomorrow. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Renee.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, spring is upon us, and you might be thinking about planning a trip. Frank Burris decided to go back to Tanzania to make a mountain trek that he had missed 15 years earlier when he was a teacher there. But the big surprise that awaited him was how much the lives of his former students had changed for the better. He will tell us more in a few minutes. But first, we want to tell you about a week-long series that begins today on NPR. It's called Looking Up: Pockets of Economic Strength. Across the network, we'll examine the parts of the U.S. economy that are beginning to thrive after the economic downturn. Here to tell us more about the series and the economy is Marilyn Giewax. She is a senior business editor at NPR. She's back with us. Once again, welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Michelle.
So tell us about this series and what you hope we will learn from it.
Well, Michelle, let me just say that if you and I had been having this conversation 3 years ago, it would have been a simple story to tell. Everything was bad. Unemployment was bad. Profits were bad. Everything was bad. But today, we realize that a lot of things actually are looking up. We found pockets of strength in things like energy, technology, manufacturing, autos especially, and agriculture. So that means these businesses are generating more personal income. That helps boost consumer confidence. In February, we saw retail sales were up, and auto sales are terrific. Stock prices have been up. Now, again, this is wildly uneven. There are nearly 13 million people still looking for work, but you can't just keep looking in the rearview mirror. A lot of things going forward really are looking up.
Tell us a little bit about the series, though. What are we going to see? Where are we going to go?
Well, we sent reporters out around the country to talk to some of these folks. So we've heard from farmers, factory workers, high-tech workers in Utah. And in many of these cases, in the stories that we'll be telling on Morning Edition and All Things Considered, things really were looking up.
Well, as you might imagine, we decided to shout out to our listeners and see what they had to say about this story. And we got a number of responses on Facebook and over email, and we're just going to play a couple of them for you. Here is Emily Wassmer from Rockland, Massachusetts.
I started as a temp last summer in the office of a manufacturing facility in Rockland. I had been working temp jobs for the past year, mostly in retail, and I did not expect to be taken on permanently, but I was hired full-time at a great entry-level wage about 3 months ago. Our company is a contractor for other companies that supply parts to General Motors and Boeing, and business here doubled in one recent year. We're not at full capacity, but things are certainly looking up.
You know, I was just thinking about what you just said about manufacturing employment, showing some signs of real improvement, durable goods manufacturing. That's some of the things that you were talking about here. Let's play another clip from listener Shubra Roy.
My family and I live in Hartford, Connecticut, and we eat out every Saturday. The wait time at the local restaurants here told us a great deal about the economy. During the slump, there were a couple of weekends when there was just us and a few other families eating at these restaurants, and these are not the expensive kind. And slowly, as things started changing, these same places now have an average wait time of about 15 to 25 minutes, which is similar to what we had before the economic downturn. So I'm sure that says a great deal about the economy.
Shubra is giving us the restaurant index. So, but I think important to mention, and if you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Senior Business Editor Marilyn G. Wax is with us, and she's talking about NPR's week-long series called Looking Up, Pockets of Economic Strength. Interested in your take on what Shubra had to say, the restaurant index, is that kind of a leading indicator? And also, you know, we have to be fair and say, what's not so rosy?
Well, in the leisure and hospitality area, we just got this new report on Friday. The Labor Department told us about what happened in February. And what we're finding is that since 2 years ago in February, exactly 2 years ago, we've added more than 500,000 jobs in restaurants. That's because people are going out again. Leisure, hospitality, tourism, those things really are looking up. And the person before that talking about manufacturing, again, we've seen jobs being added at a good clip in manufacturing, which is a refreshing change from what we saw a few years ago. Just in February, 31,000 jobs were added in manufacturing. Now, are we going to get back to where we were before the recession? No, I don't see that happening because so much new technology has come on that a lot of employers are using fewer workers to have the same output. But people are coming back, especially in auto suppliers. Auto plants are putting on third shifts. These manufacturing jobs haven't been looking up for years, and at last they are.
How big of a concern are gas prices? I mean, a new Washington Post ABC News poll shows that the public certainly is not happy about gas prices. I'm not sure you needed a poll to tell you that. But is that, are gas prices a big concern for the recovery, that this might just put the kibosh on the whole thing?
Well, absolutely. Having just said that there are these real pockets of strength, we have to acknowledge that gasoline prices, this rise in oil prices, really has the potential to derail so much of what good has been happening. Auto sales could be impacted by things like this rise in gasoline prices. And so it's something to watch, something to worry about. And, of course, there are other factors out there. The European debt crisis continues to be a real problem. China's slowdown is a potential problem. Of course, we still have our own ongoing debt and deficit problems in this country. So, yes, there are huge problems out there. For the moment, they haven't derailed this economy, but they are things to worry about.
And also, a number of our listeners wanted to be sure that we understood that there are a lot of people still struggling out there. Let me read a comment from LaShonda Barker. She sent this over Facebook. She said, I work in social services, and I continue to see college-educated unemployed on welfare. Yes, people are getting jobs below their qualifications, like buying Kraft cheese at the 99-cent store. It seems like a depression, and when people are working, but making below their needs.
We have
thoughts.
Absolutely. There are too many people out there who don't have jobs. Nearly 13 million searching for work. About 5 million people who've been unemployed for more than 27 weeks, the long-term unemployed. Many people still have part-time jobs and want to move up. And if you're in specific industries, say newspapers, you probably feel like you're in the middle of not just the Great Recession, but the Great Depression. I mean, there are still sectors that are just terrible. And we can't ignore the suffering that is still going on. But to be fair, we have to look at both what's looking up and what things are lagging.
But could you just tell us, though, Marilyn, what do you think the thing is? What is the story that you think people will be most surprised by over the course of the week? I mean, you look at these figures all the time and you keep a close eye on them. But for people who kind of are just sort of checking in, not keeping us – their own circumstances are okay, and so they're not perhaps as anxious about this. What do you think will be the most surprising?
Well, I think in the big picture for me was that a lot of times the news is skewed by what's happening on the coast. We have most of the media concentrated in along the East Coast or the West Coast. But what we did was send reporters to the heartland where things like Kansas, the sales of tractors are so good and pickup trucks because agriculture is so strong. We have another reporter in Michigan talking to people who are related to the auto industry, who are feeling good for the first time in years. Again, this story out of Utah where there are tech workers who are, you know, it's not Silicon Valley. It's kind of out there in the middle of the country where we're seeing some real success stories. And needless to say, energy is just booming in places like North Dakota. So when you look at the heartland, I think that's the surprise for those of us who live on the coasts.
Marilyn G. Wax is a senior business editor at NPR. She joined us here in our studios in Washington, D.C. Marilyn, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Oh, you're welcome. It's always a pleasure to be here.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Robert Schuller and his family are leaving the Crystal Cathedral. It is a sea change for the megachurch that towers over Orange County, California. The family is synonymous with the church. Robert Schuller founded it and launched its Hour of Power TV show. But in recent years, the Crystal Cathedral has fallen on hard times. Here's more from NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty.
Yesterday's Hour of Power opened with characteristic optimism.
If you need a lift today, you've tuned to the right program. Join us for the best hour on television, the Hour of Power from the Crystal Cathedral.
But when senior pastor Sheila Schuller Coleman began her sermon, she acknowledged that she does not always practice the positive thinking that she preaches.
So, for instance, this past week, my attitude was a little down, a little negative, making life miserable for the people around me, but most of all, moi. Myself.
Understandable, perhaps. Schuller Coleman is Robert Schuller's daughter, and she, along with the entire Schuller family, is cutting ties with the Crystal Cathedral. On Saturday, Robert Schuller, his wife, and daughter Carol announced that they are resigning from the board because of the, quote, adversarial and negative attitude of the other board members. They allege the church owes them money, something the church disputes. Now Schuller Coleman is looking for another place to preach.
This is definitely the end of an era.
Jonathan Walton is an assistant professor at Harvard Divinity School. He says when Robert Schuller opened his doors in 1955, America was in a post-war boom, economically and spiritually.
Robert Schuller's early preaching caught the spiritual strivings and desires of a post-war generation that wanted to have more, that wanted to do more, and that wanted to be more.
With the wind of positive thinking in his sails, the young Robert Schuller, a pastor in the Reformed Church in America, expanded his congregation to some 10,000 people. Millions more tuned into his services on the televised Hour of Power. He hired architect Philip Johnson to build the Crystal Cathedral in Garden Grove, California. But when Schuller tried to pass a baton to his children, Walton says, the church faltered. They preached the same positive Christianity, but without the charisma.
I think this is a quintessential example of a failure to institutionalize charismatic leadership so that it can stand the test of time.
The members grew grayer, their numbers dwindled, and so did their contributions. Meanwhile, Walton says, the church never figured out how to reach a younger generation.
We see preachers that may not have the tools of production to produce an hour of power, but they can produce 3 minutes of power on YouTube. An hour of power just may be too exhausting for Generation Y.
Crystal Cathedral Ministries filed for bankruptcy 2 years ago. And last year, the building was bought by the Catholic Diocese in Orange County. The church is planning to rent back the building for up to 3 years. But in a web video yesterday, Sheila Schuller Coleman said she's taking the choir and some of the staff to a new place to worship.
We are going to need a new home sooner than we thought, and we're moving full speed ahead.
She said the church will be called Hope Center OC, of Christ, and she hopes to find a location within a week. In the meantime, those who want to worship at the Crystal Cathedral may do so, though the church says it does not yet know who will be preaching. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.